Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, we're going to bring you an interview we did earlier today with Grandmaster Flash, one of the original masters of the turntable, one of the fathers of hip-hop and rap and everything that's followed. But first, news from Mars. Just below the surface of Mars lies trillions of gallons of frozen ice, enough water to fill over two Lake Michigans. This latest finding, published today in the journal Science, bodes well for finding evidence of past or present life on Mars. Earlier today, I spoke with William Boynton, professor of geochemistry at the University of Arizona and the lead investigator of the new study. I asked him why researchers are looking for water on Mars.
It's actually a very interesting problem because we know that Mars in the distant past had lots of water running on the surface. There are huge canyons, there are river channels that just dwarf the size of the Amazon River, for example. And we're trying to wonder, where did that water go? And so people have been looking for it for a long time, and we've been looking for it, and we were lucky enough to find it.
Is it not possible that it would have simply dried up and, evaporated right off the surface of the planet?
That was one of the suggestions, that maybe it did, in fact, because Mars has a lower gravity than Earth, it might actually have escaped the planet. And, in fact, some of it probably did, but at least now we're very happy that we've seen evidence that we still have an awful lot of this ice left, indicating that some of the water still is present.
Apart from answering the question, the issue of curiosity about where the water went, what's the importance of finding water, or ice in this case, on Mars?
Well, water's actually been far and away the most important compound on Mars, and the obvious reason for that is because it has a linkage to life. Life, as best we know, really can't exist without water, and of course there's a big question about, did Mars ever have life, and we'd like to understand what the conditions were like in the past to see if it might ever have been conducive to life having gotten started.
What you actually found, as I understand, is evidence of hydrogen, and you're projecting off of that that there's water there, is that right?
That's exactly right. What we've done is we found hydrogen, but there's so much hydrogen, it's equivalent if it were converted to water, it would be somewhere around 35% by mass. And water or ice really is about the only reasonable form in which the hydrogen could be present on Mars.
How exactly did the Mars Odyssey detect the hydrogen?
We have an instrument that we built at the University of Arizona called the gamma ray spectrometer. And there's two neutron spectrometers and a gamma ray spectrometer. And hydrogen gives off a characteristic gamma ray that tells us how much hydrogen is there. And hydrogen also affects the neutrons and changes their energies around, and that also tells us how much hydrogen is there, and we're getting essentially identical answers from all three of those parts of the gamma ray spectrometer.
Talk to us about the significance of this finding, William Boynton. What does it mean for the future of human exploration of Mars and space beyond Mars, and what does it really mean about the possibility of life on Mars itself?
Well, in terms of sending humans to Mars, at least one of the things they won't need to worry about, and that is bringing along their own supply of water. There's really a tremendous amount of water that's just a foot or two beneath the surface, so it'll be very, very easy to get to. In terms of life, this doesn't make it any more or less likely that life would have been there in the past. We knew there was a lot of water in the past. If this ice goes very deep, it may actually get to the point where it's deep enough that it's warm enough that it's molten. We might actually have pools of liquid water deep underground, and they could have life in it. We won't know for sure, of course, until we get there, and probably we'll have to bring samples back to our laboratories on Earth in order to answer that question.
Well, let's look at that one in a little more detail. If deep underground there was a molten area where the ice was water, and in that water there were tiny organisms, What would that matter?
It's at least an environment where life could form and life could exist. We have regions underground and Earth where there's no sunlight that gets into it, and organisms can live just off the heat coming from the interior of the planet. So it's at least a possible site that could be habitable. That's really all we can say.
If there were life there in some very simple form, deep in the planet, apart from it being something quite interesting, does it have some earthly impact or meaning?
I think it has a lot of impact on us just in terms of how we think about ourselves and how we think about the environment and how we think of the whole universe out there. And if we have life on Earth, it could be unique, and it could be this is the only place that ever happened. If we see it starting in two places and two places that are next door neighbors, then I think we're really forced to realize that there could be life teeming throughout the universe everywhere.
And if Mars is a great water station where humans could fill up on water or potentially even turn water into fuel, does it emerge as a potential future platform for further space exploration?
I think it could. What I would like is for us to get to Mars in the first place and then worry about what we do to get to places beyond Mars. But it certainly would help to have that way station out there. There's no doubt about that. But my guess for the foreseeable future, it'll be a long while before we send humans past Mars. It may even be a long while before we even send humans to Mars.
William Boynton, thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to help.
William Boynton is professor of geochemistry at the University of Arizona. From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
We don't care if you're age of 10 or if you're a senior citizen, because we got a beat that just won't end. So you better get ready to rock, my friend. See, we got some news that you can use, and offer that you can't refuse. We're giving up, honey, and you got to come, because you're the one.
Long before P. Diddy and Eminem and today's thousands of DJs and rappers, Joseph Sadler set up two turntables in a Bronx park, worked his magic on the vinyl, and became Grandmaster Flash. What Louis Armstrong did for jazz, Grandmaster Flash helped do for hip-hop music, pushing it from an inner-city novelty to a worldwide sensation. With an extraordinary sense of rhythm and possibility, Grandmaster Flash turned the humble turntable into an instrument as potent in its way as the piano or guitar. When young men leaned into his microphone to talk and sing over his spinning, the birth of rap was underway. Joseph Sadler, Grandmaster Flash, grew up fascinated with all things electronic and how they worked. He was a tinkerer, not content to just let the record turn. With his early idols, Kool Herc and Pete DJ Jones, he invented a new way of DJing that included scratching, cutting, and spinning the records into a tapestry of sound that is still the vocabulary for hip-hop DJs today and the baseline for a world of rap. Grandmaster Flash is still working the turntables and the crowds. He has two new CDs out and is mixing and performing in clubs across the country. We met up with him earlier today.
Raheem's gonna do the rest. Say my name is Raheem, I'm the son of a queen. I'm the king of my castle, don't give me no house. The young ladies in the place, put me on when I'm a part of your life. You can never go wrong.
Grandmaster Flash, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You were one of the very original guys who saw what could be done with a turntable back in the days of DJ Kool Herc and Africa Bambaataa. And when I look into your bio and see you've got this early childhood fascination with electronics, it starts to all make sense to me. You looked at that turntable as somebody who understood it mechanically.
Well, I think probably my first love for this thing here is probably anything that you can plug into a wall was my first interest. And this is before I even met with the turntables. Basically, I would take apart anything that was in the household, like a radio or the stereo in the living room, right, or whatever the case. I mean,
get your hands on it.
I was relentlessly trying to figure out why these things did what they did and why they did what they did. So along with that, my interest was records. So what I would do is my father had like this incredible jazz collection.
The forbidden jazz record closet.
Yeah, I used to get my head knocked off for. I was told sternly, don't do that. You cannot go in that closet right there. And what I would do is I would get a chair from the kitchen, you know, because I was a tot, and sort of slide it up the hallway to this, to this infamous closet, just enough where I can reach the knob, turn the knob, climb down. And then what was so intriguing about my father's stereo was when you turned the turntable on, there was a little red light at the bottom.
Sure, I remember those.
And it probably was the beginning of me just continuing to get my head kicked off, because I loved
staring at that little red
that
light.
Little red light, and I used to love things that spun around. So it was like, you know, I would go get these records, go to the stereo, you know, drag this chair, put the record on, get in the middle of the floor, and start dancing. And of course, I would try to, you know, put everything back the way it was. And
good luck.
Very unsuccessful.
So you got in trouble, but your parents also saw your obsession here, and they got you into electronic school. They said, hey, let's make use of this.
Now, I think probably I became publicly a public enemy number one in my house, because if the hair dryer was broke, it was like, Joseph! Or, you know, if the radio was broke, or if something electrical was broke, you know, because I would always try to put it back together. You know, it was like, you know, my mother just said, you know, listen, you just can't continue to do this. So I might as well just, you know, when you get old enough, I might as well send you to a school where you can sort of identify with these things that you want to know.
Clearly are into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's when I began to learn, like, what was a diode, what was a resistor, what was a capacitor, what was AC versus DC, what's a push-pull circuit, what was step-down transformers, what was why the resistors had these pretty colors on it. And those colors represented numbers, and that's how you read how the value of it, why a capacitor does what it does.
Here's young Joseph Sadler, born in Barbados, being raised in the Bronx, and sent...
Actually, born in the Bronx. My family hails from Barbados.
Oh, okay.
Correct.
Sorry, I got it wrong.
That's okay. You know, so basically that was kind of it. That's where it started.
So now you're off at electronic school, but you turn back into the music. What gets you actually out in public with the turntables, bringing everything you know about the electronics to the turntable, to the music?
Well, I think probably at that time, there was this great guy, man. He was one of my inspirations. He used to come out in the park. His name was Clive Campbell, and his street name was Cool Herc. And I was told, like, you know, there's this guy, you know, that plays this real great music, because the music at that time that you heard on the radio was disco. So he was playing this other music. And then, you know, for us to go see this guy, there was, like, hundreds of people around, and he has this 6 feet and change guy, heavily guarded, with this incredible sound system, playing these songs.
And making an impression on the future Grandmaster Flash.
I think, you can say that, but I mean, what I found intriguing, like I had two heroes. It was Cool Herc, and it was like DJ Jones. And the thing was, with Cool Herc, I loved the music that he was playing. But in the fashion he was playing it, it wasn't seamless. It was like, you know, he might play a record that was 82 beats per minute, and then the next one might be 110, where, you know, if you're watching a bunch of heads dancing to the beat at the same time,
they can't make that transition.
It's like I call it disarray in unison. Mm-hmm. You know, so it would be unison, and then when you would change the record, it would be disarray, because everybody had to find the beat,
find
and then unison. So that became, like, the focal point of my frustration. Like, there has to
how
be
to
a
work
way,
out that transition.
How to work it out where it can just be seamless.
We'll continue our conversation with Grandmaster Flash after a short break. We're going into the break with his mix of the Africa Bambaataa classic Planet Rock from the new CD Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. New York, New York, big city of dreams, and everything in New York ain't always what it seems. You might get fooled if you come from out of town, but I'm down by law and I know my way around. Too much, too many people, too much. Too much, too many people, too much. Breakdown! In the end, we fight. To New York, we owe our bought and sold, and everybody thinks they're right. War is a game of business, a game we shouldn't play, because men with guns killed all our sons, and we must all wait, and they call
COVID. Well, paranoia is almost over. Cause nobody hears what the people say. Well, paranoia is almost over.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point, and we're here tonight with the great hip-hop original, Grandmaster Flash. Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five's rap song, The Message, took rap music to a new level. Before this song, the lyrics of rap music were essentially boasting and bragging of rap prowess and girlfriends and hot cars. Grandmaster Flash and his crew saw that political and social messages had a place in rap, too. Their cut, The Message, talked of the frustrations of ghetto life, of poverty and hopelessness and rage.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room, roaches in the back, junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far, cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head.
You begin to bring in a kind of social message. Say, hey, things are not so good here. Or, hey, watch out for that cocaine. Was that your idea, or was this the guys who were vocalizing over your turntable work?
This is what I have to really make clear here. The song White Lines was vocally the genius of Melly Mel. It was his song, and I want to give him like 100% credit on this song. I wouldn't even call it a Grandmaster Flash song. I call it a Melly Mel masterpiece.
Of course, he was in the Furious Five, but this was his inspiration.
This is after we parted, and this was a project that was undone when we parted. And this is something that he finished. This is something that he did. And then it was an engineer by the name of Chris Lord Alge who sort of came up with this way of taking a rhythm and making it like an arpeggiating sort of sound thing. So it was, I would give that song to Melly Mel and Chris Lord Alge.
Vision, dreams of passion. And all the while I think of you. A very strange reaction. The more I see, the more I do. Baby,
tell your body to come along. But white lines blow away.
It depicted, you know, a part of our lives. Because, I mean, at one point, you know, we were in a company of, like, the huge, I mean,
the snowstorm of cocaine.
And not even that, but huge artists that kind of did it. You know, we were around the biggest, and, like, people we grew up with, and, like, not all of them did drugs, but it was a pleasure to play with the Commodores or Rick James or playing with Evelyn Champagne King or playing with the Barquets or playing with, the list just goes on and on. Like, people that were our superheroes, now we were on a stage with these people. So
what did you think when you first heard Blondie take Rapture out? It became such a big hit, and here's, of course, a white band kind of dipping in. Deborah Harris had come and listened to you and talked about you in the song. What did you make of that way of the music having its big coming out party?
Well, I take it as a pleasure because, actually, I have to give this to Fab Five Freddy, because Fab Five Freddy is like, you know, was this cat that hung down in the village. And a village was an area in New York where the white people and the foreigners used to party. Okay? And the thing about it is that Fab used to come to a Flash party, which was up in the Bronx, but he was like a town crier. He would go downtown into the village and say, yo, there's these parties, man, that you got to come see. You know, Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash, you guys got to come uptown and see it. And, like, they weren't too happy about wanting to come up because of the scenario of what people thought it was, which wasn't true, you know?
Right.
He had promised me that he would bring one of his best friends, which I thought was crap, you know, Deborah Harry to the party. I'm like, mm-hmm. yeah, right.
You're going to bring Deborah Harry, right.
He says, yeah, she's a good friend of mine, and Chris Stein's a real good friend. These are good friends of mine. I'm like, yeah, right, you're going to bring them. And maybe two or three weeks later, you know, that's Blonde, yes. And I was playing Webster PAL, and primarily all my audience at that time was, like, Spanish and blacks. And then it was this woman with this blonde hair coming, like, from out of the darkness up close to the stage, and like,
you remember that moment?
Yeah, he pulled it off.
She was there,
and she says, I've been watching you for like an hour, and she says, I'm very pleased with the way you do your thing on the turntables, and I'm going to write a song about you. And I basically was like, oh, thank you very much. But in my mind, you know, I was like, yeah, right, yeah, this is crap. You ain't going to talk about, why would she want to talk about a kid in the Bronx that doesn't have near the superstar stardom status that she even had?
But that song became a huge song.
Yeah, like 3 weeks later, maybe like a month later, yeah. The song was out, and people were saying, Flash, you made a new song. I'm like,
I don't think so exactly.
I don't have no songs out. Then I went to research it, and she kept her word. She actually did do it, and she opened up, like, so many doors.
What did you think in the 80s when this became so mainstream and began to take off in such a big way? Did you think, I gave birth to that? Or wait, someone's sort of stolen my horses here?
I was happy. I mean, because at that time, hip-hop was still in a proving stage. And it had not been totally saturated to the foreigners or to the whites or to the Germans or to whatever. And for Blondie to just come into the hood, embrace it, and then go and record this, because she still was, even if she didn't make that song, she still was a superstar, so she didn't even have to make the song. So for her to have even done it was really, like, I took it as like an ultimate compliment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Flash is fast, Flash is cool. I'm like, whoa, this is really, and I thought it was real cute that she, you know, she even attempted to put a rap on there, you know, the eating cars, eating bars. Kind of,
right.
Sort of, let's just say,
hello.
Listening, like, wow,
listening.
Eating cars and bars and Mars. And that there was sort of another twist of vocalizing, let's just say.
Yeah, let's say. When you look out on this whole enormous world today, what do you think of the way it's evolved? What do you think of the guys who have made the enormous bucks off of it, Puff Daddy and that whole world?
I'm so happy, because this is one thing that's inevitable in life, and this is the way that I see it. Contrary to what a lot of people say, it's mm-hmm. like, I am one of the creators of this art form, but there's one thing that we have no control of, and that is change. And either you adapt to change, or change will take care of you.
Yes, it will.
And basically, what I feel with all the later artists that have come after Grandmaster Flash, Kool Herc, and Africa Bambaataa, it's a blessing, because now it just opens up the door for more possibility. It's just a matter of being able to look and find your niche where you are. It's like, these new artists keep me alive, because when you speak about hip hop chronologically, you have to include Flash, hands down. You know, so that's almost like advertisement for me. All I have to do is be present and do my thing.
That's right, because you're there in the beginning. But when you look at, I don't know, Eminem, what do you think?
When I think about, I think he's a genius. I think he's a little controversial, but I just think that he opens more doors for other people, mm-hmm. for hip-hop. And, like, some of his subject matters are get him in situations where it's not, let's just say, happy situations. Mm-hmm. But then hip-hop is controversial anyway, because and it's diverse, because it has different points of view. Like when Herc and Flash and Bam created this, you know, let's just say we were red. But then a person in Japan felt the love for it, and they made it blue. And then maybe somebody in California made it yellow.
A different color every time.
You know, so it's a different hue. And the thing about it is that if you don't have some sort of, let's just call the word controversy, I like to call it diversity. If you don't have, then the people ain't paying attention, because then it's too dormant. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's just the way that it is.
Under all those colors, is there a message? Is there a fundamental message in the hip-hop arena?
I think the fundamental message to me is, please come with your point of view. I want, like, that 6-year-old kid that's doing it right now will probably be the man 10 years from now. Like, please keep coming with the new cut. That MC, please come with the new style. Please, the producers, come with that new way of taking a beat, because unlike all other genres of music, hip-hop, hands down, has unlimited ways of being created. We can metamorphosize this in so many different ways, whereas with other than jazz, I mean, rock, blues, like, they have they're formatted to some
degree.
Fixed
framework to some way.
And hip-hop is not. We can talk about almost anything. We can sing off-key. We can take a Frank Sinatra record. I can make mix a Frank Sinatra record with Billy Squire, Big Beat, and make it work and call it hip-hop.
And is there room for every emotion in there as well? Love, hate, anger, joy, or does it lean one way or another?
No, I think that it's unlimited, because, I mean, like you had Run DMC talk about a pair of sneakers, my Adidas. I mean, you can go like there. You know, you could have like a person like Biz Markie who can't sing a lick. You know, you got what I need, and it's a big song. I mean, you got people talking about, you know, it's like a jungle sometimes. You know, don't push me because I'm close to the edge. And, you know, we're just so unlimited with what we could do. So, like, hip-hop is a wonderful, wonderful thing, and I think the way it's grown, I'm quite happy.
And your turntable work on the new album, how does it compare with what you were doing 5 years ago, 20 years ago? I mean, you were famous for using your hands, your feet, your wrist, your elbow, anything you could make it work. What new techniques are you bringing in?
Well, I think techniques, I think probably the way that I work with an audience is I become them, they become me. And in the transition, I want us to positively get wild and get crazy. So if the audience got me crazy, I might go into a thing where I don't know what I might do, but it's like improv every night, and that's probably why I love it so much, because there's no set template, there's no set format to what I'm going to do on a particular night. If the audience is wild, I'm getting wild with them.
How did you choose the songs on this album? What were you looking for?
I was looking for flow, because when I tried to come up with a format or a template, it was extremely hard to do, because the songs of that particular era was so strong. There were so many hits. So I came up with a bunch of composite mixes, and this one sort of felt the best. It felt the best as a first step, you know, because I want to do a couple of volumes of these. So this is, as a first step, I'm pretty happy with it.
In the age of CDs, it's not vinyl, it's CD now. How does this turntable work stay alive?
Well, quite frankly, I'd have to say that the DJ is the first line of defense when it comes to a record. And a lot of these companies now, record companies, are finding it extremely important to be able to service the DJ, because the DJ is going to take this into a club or into an arena, brand spanking new, and sort of retest it. So vinyl, although it is not the, it doesn't sell as much as a CD, it cannot die.
They have to keep making them so that you can play with them.
They must. I mean, but unfortunately, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, it comes down to dollars and cents. And from what I'm told, and I'm not really super clear about it, but it costs damn near nothing to make a CD, and you can make 10 times a profit versus making vinyl. You know, you don't make the same profit. So from a business standpoint, I would guess they would lean more towards the CD thing. But the fact of the matter is here, the true mixers that really do their thing with the vinyl are the ones who have the reputations. They have the following, and
is it an honor? Is it a privilege when the mixer comes in and mixes someone's song? Do the artists say, "Oh, please, you know, play with this, take my song"?
Absolutely. I mean, I get artists come to me and say, "Flash," like I get record companies calling me all the time, whether it's Columbia, Warner Brothers, EMI, RCA, or whatever the case may be. Got something new, Flash? I want you to take with you and just go test this. I know why they want me to test it, because a lot is leaning on whether that song is successful or whether it dies. So
and you can help make it a success by your
treatment of it. Funkmaster Flex can help. Rock Radio can help, DJ Scribbles can help. It's like, you know, we are the first line of defense with the people, you know. And the record companies, they go the typical way, which is to radio, then it has to go through rotation, and mm-hmm. it has to go through the powers that be, and whatever, whatever. If this has got a funky beat, we ain't going through all that. You know,
let's just play right now.
Let's get down.
What comes after hip-hop? Or does hip-hop just morph endlessly?
Hip-hop's, I would pray to God that it continues to be here. I hope that them DJs continue to do the things they do in the turntables and take my formula to the next level, and I would hope that MC would continue to do the poetry to the beat of music. I would hope and pray.
Do you still have the same joy in it today, Grandmaster Flash, Joseph Sadler?
Oh, yeah. I think I have more joy because now I have more to play with now because I've mastered the old school stuff. So now it's just so much new music, and it's so much so many different types of new music that I can play. I'm like a big kid at heart. And I
so speaking of kids, you have a lot of kids.
I got six
now, right?
I got six kids, yeah.
What do they listen to your music? Do they think you're cool, or do they think you're history?
My kids think I'm the coolest dad. Because
they
I mean,
should.
You know, because I
my dad is Grandmaster Flash. Come on.
I ask him so many questions. I ask him what's the latest thing, what's the latest dance, where can I see the latest thing happening? I'm constantly keeping my ear to the street of what's going on. It's really important to
me. Is the Bronx still your feeding ground, your most fertile area to find that, or?
No, probably more like I travel around. I travel mm-hmm. around the country.
Sure,
now.
Of course.
I ask plenty of questions, and like I play, you know, God has given me this wonderful gift that enables me to play for an audience. I can play for 18-year-olds in a room and play their music. Mm-hmm. And they give me somewhat of a musical barometer of what's hot and what's not mm-hmm. versus I can play for an audience that's older, mature audience. So I can take it across the board, you know. I think right now there's just a constant want to learn more knowledge. Now I'm into want to learn this house music thing. Like that's what I want to learn next.
House music, what do you need to learn there?
If I was given 15 R&B and hip-hop songs and asked to put them into a mix from warmest song to hottest song, I can do that successfully. Mm-hmm. If 15 songs were put down of house in front of me, I probably could mix them on time, but I wouldn't know what was hot and what was not. And what makes a hot song? And what makes a body? What makes him or her move the way they do to this particular style of music? Because my thing is, this music is a universal language.
Does heat move? Has heat changed? Has what's hot? The fundamentals of it changed over time?
Yeah, I think with modern technology, it has metamorphosized. I think that the same components apply, but I just think these producers are just taking these parts and just sort of twisting them and making them sound different. But I think they're taking the elements and the essence of the same sounds and just putting somewhat of a 2000 mm-hmm. sort of twist on it.
We'll continue our conversation with Grandmaster Flash after a short break. Here's his mix of the classic Last Night a DJ Saved My Life by In Deep. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Last night a DJ saved my life. Last night a DJ saved my life, yeah. 'Cause I was sitting there bored to death. And in just one breath he said, you gotta get up, you gotta get off, you gotta get down, girl. No, you drive me crazy, baby. You've got to turn into another man. Called you on the phone, no one's home. Baby, why leave me all alone? And if it wasn't for the music, I don't know what I'd do.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour to one of the great innovators of the hip-hop scene, Grandmaster Flash. He's got a new album out called The Essential Mix Classic Edition, where he mixes some of the greatest DJ hits of the 70s and 80s. Here's his treatment of the famous track by Liquid called Cavern.
It's not a problem that I can't fix, 'cause I can do it in the mix. And if your man gives you trouble, just improve out on the double, and you don't let it trouble your brain, 'cause away goes trouble down the drain. Said away goes trouble down the drain.
You're the master of that technology, the vocalization, the lyrics. How much do they matter to you? Or is it all what's going on underneath that really gets your focus?
I think underneath. And I think that probably, like, I listen to lyrics. I'm pretty deep with lyrics. But one thing I realize is this here. If you're going to be a servant to the public, you cannot judge. And that's what it comes down to. So, like, I won't play, for a underage little five-year-old. I wouldn't play the A side of a certain record that had lots of profanity in
it's
it.
Really
I'd play
raw.
I'd play the B side where they have the edit version of it. Mm-hmm. You know, so I mean, so I do have a conscience, but I mean, overall, I'm playing the hits. So if that means I got to go in there and play maybe 60% old school and 40% new school, or vice versa, you know, whatever it is, I'm just trying to be that ultimate musical servant.
But you're not
going to
pass
public.
Judgment on the new school, where it's so raw, it's so sexual, it's so misogynistic sometimes.
Because it was the same way back in the days.
Mm-hmm.
It was always
making an uproar.
Same Donna Summers was, oh, I love to love you, baby.
Right, of course.
I mean, it's the same thing, the same crap, you just got a different spin on it. You know, and what's happening is with a lot of adults, if you just took the time to just pay attention and listen, like, these kids have their own language. Just like when we were kids, we had our own language, and sometimes we want to do things against a grain, and that's just the way the kids are.
And what do you think of the way the white youth have embraced rap? Is that just absolutely going to happen the same way white people embrace jazz? Or is it strange?
I am so happy that they did, because, I mean, the fact of the matter is, say, when I first was doing this thing, I would play a white jam, a black jam, a jazz mm-hmm. jam, a rock jam, a blues jam, whatever. So even the template in the very beginning was play it all if it's funky. So now my thing is I want to play in front of all audiences so that I can get funky. Mm-hmm. And that means now that I have to sort of upstep my knowledge and widen my horizons musically by listening to some house music, or possibly listening to some techno, or probably listening to some whatever is getting the bodies moving. I want to be able to service that public with that.
The message, your song, said, "Don't push me because I'm close to the edge. It's like a jungle sometimes. Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. I swear I might hijack a plane." When you look out at the world today and see the anger that's out there that's been expressed in New York City in the last 9 months, do you understand it?
Well, I mean, that particular song there had, it's probably going to be one of the songs that will probably go down in history, because it's just as new as it was when it was made in 1982. And basically the song depicts stress and sort of the things that happens in urban America. It's sort of like a window to urban America, to people who were afraid to come into urban America.
Take a look in here.
It was a musical window. That's how I look at that song. It was a musical, like, look into this window here, and you can get somewhat of an idea of how things happen in urban America.
But we see some of that kind of attitude, that anger, globally now. Does it worry you?
I think it does, but I don't know how I can even sort of make a comment on it. Mm-hmm. I think that there is some things that are going on that are not of a hip-hop nature. It's just life in general. Things are moving a lot faster. And some people are like, wow, like, what's going on here? What's going on there? And things, it's like now the world has come to, it's got to be done right now.
Mm-hmm.
Where at one point, we probably moved a little slower.
Hang in, wait a little.
In a prior century now, and even with artists, they get, like, straight out the press, they get a 6-week run. And if they don't happen right away, they get shelved. Whereas back, you know, maybe in the 80s and 90s, it was like, okay, we're going to sign this artist because we believe in maybe we can get 10 years out of this artist. So the first year, we're going to develop this artist. Mm-hmm. And we're going to let them make all the mistakes they can make. And then we're going to come back and give them a second album. And hopefully they will learn and they will sort of will polish this diamond carefully. Whereas now, you got to come out the gate running. And if you don't come out the gate running, it's like all of a sudden now your horse is stopped. So that could be a little scary for artists, and it can be a little stressing for artists, and I sympathize with them.
Absolutely.
When it comes to that, you know, from that perspective.
Joseph Sadler, Grandmaster Flash, we are so glad you're still doing what you're doing, and we're so honored you came in to spend this time with us today.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Grandmaster Flash's new CD is Grandmaster Flash Essential Mix. If you're in the Boston area, Grandmaster Flash will be performing at the Club Embassy tonight at midnight. For more information on him and his performance, go to our website, onpointradio.org. In a moment, sounds of the last week. Friday night. Let's listen back to the events of the week.
It'll be my utmost endeavor to avoid conflict. And I've been saying that all along, that conflict will only take place here if it is initiated by India. We will not be the initiators. This is my guarantee.
My instinct on this subject is to simply recognize that the two countries are clearly in a situation where they are not talking directly to each other, and they have substantial disagreements, particularly with respect to the LOC in the Kashmir area.
Although the calendars will tell us that it has taken three seasons, fall, winter, and spring, many of us have no recollection of these changes. We just got up day after day, dressed accordingly, and went about the monumental task of making sense out of absurdity, of bringing order out of chaos, and reclaiming our humanity from the violence which seeks to make human life less human.
After 9/11, it became clearer than ever that we had to fundamentally change the way we do our business. Responding to the post 9/11 realities requires a redesigned and a refocused FBI.
He doesn't know. He said he simply he blacked out. The last thing he recalls is that he left. He was passing the buoy, and the next thing he remembers, he had already impacted the bridge.
Cabinet is under review, that in order to reduce and also stop the infiltration of terrorists to Israel, we have to build a fence, and the decision is clear that we are going to do it as soon as possible.
It certainly is a step in the right direction, but I don't think it resolves the entire issue, resolves all the outstanding issues that have to be dealt with respect to Libya and Pan Am 103.
And there was the week tensions mounting between India and Pakistan. Donald Rumsfeld preparing for a visit to India and Pakistan next week. The ringing of a bell at the solemn ceremony on Thursday when the final beam, the stick they called it, was removed from Ground Zero. A minister speaking there to workers at that ceremony. FBI Director Robert Mueller announcing dramatic revamping at the FBI. A Memorial Day weekend tragedy as a barge strikes a bridge in Oklahoma, killing at least 14. Israeli Foreign Minister Shimon Peres pushes for the swift construction of a fence between Israel and the Palestinian territories. And Secretary of State Colin Powell reacts to reports that a settlement is being negotiated between the Libyan government and families of the victims of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland, a settlement that would reportedly hinge on U.S. sanctions against Libya being dropped. Quite a week and more to come. Next week on Point, we'll be talking with Bobby McFerrin. We'll be talking about welfare mothers, and we'll be talking about the search for life in this universe. We're going to go out tonight with the song that made tonight's guest, Grandmaster Flash, famous for speaking to all that's difficult in this world. From Grandmaster Flash, The Message.
Makes me wonder how I keep from going under. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Broken glass everywhere. People pissing on the stairs. You know they just don't care. I can't take the smell. Can't take the noise. Got no money to move out. I guess I got no choice. Rats in the front room. Roaches in the back. Junkies in the alley with the baseball bat. I tried to get away, but I couldn't get far. Cause a man with a tow truck repossessed my car. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under. Standing on the front stoop, hanging out the window, watching all the cars go by, roaring as the breezes blow. A crazy lady living in a bag, eating out of garbage bells, used to be a fag hag. Such a dance to tango, skipped the life and dango. A zircon princess seemed to lost her senses. Down at the beach show, watching all the creeps, so she could tell her stories to the girls back home. She went to the city and got so did it. She had to get a pitch, she couldn't make it on her own.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Darren Mnuchin, and Wambui Wamunyu. Michael Garth is our ambassador of funk. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. A special thanks to a departing intern tonight, Jamie Kirchick. Good luck to you. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Collectors to ring my phone and scare my wife when I'm not home. Got a bum education, double-digit inflation. Can't take the train to the job. There's a strike at the station. Neon King Kong standing on my back. Can't stop to turn around. Broke my sacroiliac. A mid-range migraine, cancer membrane. Sometimes I think I'm going insane. I swear I might hijack a plane. Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
This is W.